Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, Head of the Department of Languages and Linguistics at La Trobe University. This is episode CLXX, Roman Luxury and Wealth. If archaeological digs are anything to go by, Rome was a society of fantastic luxury, impressive buildings, exotic foods, obedient slaves, and more marble than you could shake a toga at. But when you read ancient sources, there were those who felt uncomfortable with all this opulence, and the thought that it could be making the Romans soft. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
So we think of the Romans, I suppose, in popular culture as living an opulent lifestyle.
As quite decadent. Often.
Yeah, it's absolutely decadent. You know, they're having orgies in these decadent surroundings where grapes are being fed to them and they're on golden couches and there's water features and beautiful gardens. And it's true that they did have these beautiful gardens and there was luxury. They had the ability to import luxury goods, gems and metals and beautiful marbles from the East. But a very, very small percentage, as you might guess, of the Roman population had that kind of wealth and that ability to kind of navigate the Roman world in that way. We're probably talking the senatorially wealthy, maybe the equestrians.
Yeah.
So the Senate at its biggest is 900 men and their families. They're the ones with, by that period, 4 million sesterces in wealth. Equestrians have to have 1 million. It's not going to be 1% of the Roman world. It's going to be 0.00-something percent.
Yeah. Okay. But considering how we research Rome, the process of archaeology, we are invariably digging up the big villas and where the money is in Rome. I know that a lot of research today is done into how the everyday man lived. But if you go back to the 1800s, you're getting the opulence of Rome. So that could kind of cloud our perception of it, I guess, a bit, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. It's very much tied up with the fact that our history of rediscovering Rome was originally an interest in beautiful objects and not so much in even discovering how the high and mighty lived, but look, here's a statue that I can drag away and put in my garden.
Yes.
So those are the objects and eventually those are the villas that initially captured people's interest. And, you know, that's the kind of lifestyle that is then emulated in building something like the Getty Museum in Malibu, which is that direct copy of the Villa of the Papyri, where possibly Piso, Caesar's father-in-law, lived. So that's the kind of circle that has kind of captured our imagination. Of course, it looks great on film or in paintings even before that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess that's why we think of it. But to a certain extent, it's true. It's true for that small minority that they have this wealth and they are able to live this extremely luxurious lifestyle. At the same time, there is kind of this moral discourse of, especially amongst philosophers in some literary works too, that this is bad for us. This is potentially going to lead to our downfall. So the Romans kind of question themselves. They kind of fall over themselves to think about the downside of all of this luxury, all of this power to bring in, to import this wealth.
Yes.
Especially about importing.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because I guess the received wisdom, and to a certain extent I'd buy into it, is that the Roman world is more open. You know, it's built upon asylum, Romulus's asylum, that others can come in. And we know that a lot of people came into Rome from all parts of the Mediterranean and that it was what we would think of as this multicultural mix. But it's not quite as simple as that. It's not utopian like that. And foreign objects coming in, there is this critique of that. At the same time as they're enjoying it, I guess at the most extreme end, you might have somebody like the elder Pliny, or earlier, maybe someone like Cato.
Yeah.
Cato the Younger, questioning what this empire and its power to import luxury is doing to the Romans, doing to their soul, as it were.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you've put up a good example there. You've got Cato, who famously liked to live modestly, like dressed simply in black, and that was a mark of a man who had high morals, I guess, and was very ethical. And also, you've got somebody like, I guess, Seneca, who would wax lyrical about doing it tough for a period of time, living simply just to say that he
does that.
He's capable of it.
He's capable
of it. Doesn't have to do it for the whole year.
No, no, no. Of course not. But at the same time, these are men who can afford to live like this, who can afford to think like that.
Yeah, and it's interesting that both the examples you've picked out there, I mean, I mentioned Cato, but you brought in Seneca, they're both Stoics. And I think that, to a certain extent, feeds into talking about luxury and wealth and questioning it. That because if you're a Stoic, you don't have to, as maybe Cato did, live extremely frugally, but you have to be able to face up to any kind of hardship with the way we use the word stoic, isn't it? Face it stoically, not show emotion, not be kind of cast down by it.
Yeah.
So Seneca has to be able to demonstrate that at the same time as he's the richest man in the Neronian world.
He's the richest man in Rome, full stop. It's kind of him and Herodes Atticus. We can't decide who is more wealthy. So, yeah. Probably Mr. I Built a Theatre, actually. So, give him a run for his money.
Seneca's, I think we've said it on this podcast before, lending money to entire provinces.
That's right. He was propping up provinces. Yeah.
It's wealth beyond your wildest imagination. I mean, maybe we can imagine it these days because we've got so many billionaires, but it seems like there's so many of them, they're almost 10 a penny now, whereas it's always going to be pretty rare in the Roman world.
So you said that there was the thought that excess in Rome can bring about its downfall. Can you kind of dig into that a bit? Who was saying that and why?
Lots of people are saying that. This idea that there's going to be too much. Often it's expressed as weakening Romans, and often it's got this gender element. So it's somehow going to impugn their masculinity, especially of soldiers, but of Roman men in general. Historians talk about it a lot, often because they like to pinpoint a particular date where this began. So by the time we get to the late Republic and the Augustan period, historians are saying it's already well in train. And they have different dates for it. So Livy gives 187 BCE, and this is because the spoils of Asia are brought in. So this is the beginning of Rome's conquest of Greece and, you know, the Greek East. He calls it the seeds of future destruction. It's a great phrase.
Yeah.
And this is about luxury goods and slaves from the East. Now, this has an economic angle as well. It drives up prices of everyday goods. He says it leads to self-indulgence and extravagance. Obviously, it's only leading to that if it is amongst those who can afford to buy them. But of course, we do know that the growth of empire and the growth of wealth that some people built out of it led to this kind of polarization of Roman society. So the wealthy become very, very wealthy. This is sounding very much like our present in some ways, or the way some people would analyze our present. The wealthy become wealthier, what we call the 1%.
1%, yeah.
And the poor are kind of left, we would often say, without a secure employment, perhaps. For them, it's without land.
Okay.
Because the wealthy can buy up more and more land. So property is everything, even though we're talking about objects like rich couches or tripods or jewelry. Land is eventually where your wealth is really situated. This kind of extravagance, this kind of wealth, is what we'd call conspicuous consumption. So while the wealthy have always owned a lot of land, now they own more of it and they've got this stuff to put on show. And that has already, by this period, 187, Livy's date, led to something we talked about before, which is those sumptuary laws, sumptuary legislation that stops people displaying, especially women, wearing certain colours, going around in carriages, that kind of thing, to kind of at least cut off some of the jealousy that might come from this conspicuous consumption.
Yeah.
So when he says the spoils from Asia in 187, I've got a good quote here from book 39, chapter 6, paragraph 9, and it really goes into detail about what it is that's being brought back. And Livy says, it was through the army serving in Asia, by which he means Asia Minor, modern Turkey, that the beginnings of foreign luxury were introduced into the city. He only ever calls it the city. He means Rome. These men brought into Rome for the first time bronze couches, costly coverlets, tapestry and other fabrics, and what was at the time considered gorgeous furniture, pedestal tables and silver trays. Banquets were made more attractive by the presence of girls who played on the harp and sang and danced, and by other forms of amusement, and the banquets themselves began to be prepared with greater care and expense. The cook, whom the ancients regarded and treated as the lowest menial, was rising in value, and what had been a servile office came to be looked upon as a fine art. He really objects to the fact that culinary arts have become an art, that it's not just this thing you do as, you know, it's functional to keep you going. You eat food.
Yeah, yeah.
Now it's become something that you pay attention to, just as you would with a painting or a sculpture. So Livy says 187. It's one of the earlier dates. A popular one is the one Sallust fixes on. Sallust, very moralistic historian. He says 146, which is a good date because, of course, it's the twin capture and destruction of both Carthage and Corinth by the Romans. So you've got kind of the wealth of the whole Carthaginian empire and this really important Greek city, which the capture of Corinth really represents. Rome now has control of the Greek mainland and creates provinces. And so Sallust says life becomes easy after that conquest. He doesn't talk as much about the luxury coming in. It's more about the fact that Rome hasn't got an enemy that it needs to be tough for.
Mm-hmm.
But undoubtedly, the conquest of these two places means there are more riches to come in.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly slaves from the east and I guess from the south as well are now readily available for the Romans.
I think this says more about Sallust and the people who are having these thoughts, but it's interesting that they're equating the end or the downfall as being living too comfortably, you know, that they think that that's that much of a bad thing. The reason that I'm kind of edging into that is because Tacitus, much later, has the idea that a way to pacify barbarians is to give them nice things. So that comes up in the Agricola.
Indeed. It's the same discourse going on there. And Livy also says that the Carthaginians, when they, during the Second Punic War, when they're in southern Italy, you know, for almost a couple of decades, they're kind of rampaging around Italy with Hannibal.
With a few elephants.
And when they're in southern Italy in particular, which is the richer part of Italy, you know, inhabited by Greeks from long before, around Capua, I think it is, that they kind of descend into this sort of languid lifestyle because everything's on hand. Certainly there's not the religious component, but the closest parallel I can think of that our listeners might be familiar with is that kind of puritanical work ethic, that if you're not having to struggle for something, if you're not having to work for it or fight someone for it, you know, you'll just become lazy.
Yeah.
You'll just become soft. Where I come from in Britain, it's what Northerners think of Southerners. They just work in offices. They don't get out there and do that. I mean, it's not, plenty of people in the North work in offices now as well. This is a real old-fashioned stereotype.
Yeah.
This worry that there's not a challenge anymore, I guess, is something that the Romans grapple with. Livy grapples with it right from his preface. He has a very famous preface to his long history. His preface is usually divided into three parts, and in the second main part, he says, what I'm going to write about, it's not going to be popular, but I need to write about this. It's important. He says, we started off with foreign war. Dominion was won and extended by this. Then as the standard of morality gradually lowers, the reader is going to have to follow the decay of the national character, which is going to slip downward more and more rapidly and finally plunge headlong into ruin. And then there's a famous quote. He says, until he reaches these days in which we can bear neither our diseases nor their remedies. He doesn't overtly mention wealth there, but it's pretty clear that this is part of what he regards as this downward spiral. We can't even think about how to put this right. It's part of this, I'm going to call it discourse, this conversation that was going on in the late Republic and into the Augustan period about how have we fallen apart like this? How have we had all this civil war? How can we identify where this has come from? And one of the main ways the elite Romans, whose writings we have, identify the seeds of their civil wars is clearly life had become too easy. We didn't have foreigners to fight anymore because we'd conquered them all and taken all of their wealth. So we started fighting ourselves. So that's kind of, in brief, the rationale. And one of the reasons that we get so much talk about luxury and luxury being bad.
I mean, I kind of see this as the very low minority opinion as well. I mean, Livy might be criticizing this, but the vast majority of the Romans who had this sort of money and who had fancy chefs and pools full of lampreys and nice mosaics and everything would have been completely fine with it.
Well, you can say that, but we have more of this moralizing than we do people celebrating luxury, I guess.
Hmm.
And it's true that when the luxury is celebrated, and by the way, we should have said straight up that our word luxury comes from the Latin word luxuria, which is often used in this very negative way as being too extravagant.
So it's a negative word.
Yeah, often is. When, say, somebody like Pliny, who we're going to talk about, the elder Pliny, talks about beautiful but very expensive buildings, say, it's usually about public building. So it'll be the Augustan Forum, state building as well, a state monument.
Yes.
But it's open to the public. It's not your dining room that's full of all of these treasures.
Yeah, and Augustus being praised for his building projects, they are all projects that he's made for the good of the public.
And living frugally himself.
But then you've got Nero, who's building a golden house for himself and is just, you know, criticized in most of the sources that we've
got. It's not literally made of gold, but no, yes, you're quite right.
You know,
it's called
what I mean, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, there is a theory that, in fact, Nero was going to open that house to the public, but we don't know. It was called a house. It was called Domus, which implies private, and it's basically a villa in the middle of Rome. So yeah, so that's also a distinction that's made from the Augustan period on, and Augustus himself kind of plays on that and solidifies that public versus private difference. Yeah, it's true that a lot of our writers might be of this more conservative frame of mind. And of course, if everyone thought that, then nobody would have been importing all this luxury and wanting to show it off. It is surprising how much Roman writers talk about how damaging this is.
Okay, so there was a lot going on when it comes to decoration, and I guess that is found offensive is mostly in the private arena. So what exactly is being found offensive by the writers?
One of the main areas of attention is extravagant building works. So we talked, or Livy told us that, you know, it's about silver trays and so on, so small objects, but also these big extravagant projects that really capture the public eye, sometimes involving huge feats of engineering, are often seen as over the top, as almost conquering nature. And so marble comes in for a lot of it because you're kind of cutting it, hacking it out of a hillside and then importing it. It's very expensive often, especially if you've brought it from a Greek island, as many of them were. At the same time, there is perfectly good marble in Italy. There's Carrara marble, which is incredibly beautiful too and tends to be used for statues and, you know, that white flooring that you sometimes get. So having to bring it across the seas in itself, because it's a huge operation importing marble across the seas.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty heavy. It offends the elder Pliny in particular, this importing of marble. I think if we were to encounter Pliny now, we would regard him perhaps more than any other as a racist, because he's always talking about how importing stuff is bad. Like indigenous is better. Stuff coming from elsewhere, always bad.
Oh, so Rome first.
Yeah, kind of. He really doesn't like this bringing other stuff in. And he tells this tale of how Lucullus, the late Republican politician, was so fond of this very expensive black marble, which we now give the name Africano. It actually became called Lucullan marble.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He says, this is from the Natural History book 36, chapter 49. 4 years after this, Lucius Lucullus was consul. The latter gave his name, as it appears, to Lucullan marble. So much was it admired by him. And he was the first to bring it to Rome. It is in general black, although other marbles are favoured because of their markings or colours. So he's having a go there. It's not even the best or most interesting marble.
Mm.
He tells us it comes from the island of Melos. And he says, this marble is almost unique in that it takes its name from its devotee. Now, he doesn't mean any of that as a compliment. You know, Lucullus gets it named after him. We could think, oh, isn't that wonderful or interesting? He thinks this man is so obsessed with it. And you shouldn't really be obsessed with a thing, especially an expensive thing. This is like a bad mark against Lucullus for him. And then the tale of Lucullan marble kind of tracks its way through the late Republic, really. So in 58 BCE, another politician called Scaurus uses Lucullan marble to build these enormous columns just for his temporary theatre.
Yes.
So this very expensive marble that has to be imported from a Greek island. He has 360 columns. I can't even imagine how this happened in a temporary theatre, or maybe even a permanent one. 360 columns put up for his temporary theatre in 58, and this is because he's standing for office. He wants to impress the Roman public. They were 38 feet tall. I should have got the metric equivalent there.
What That's okay.
That I don't know, 10 meters around. And then, all right, so this was for, albeit temporary, a public space, a theatre where performances would be put on. It's ridiculous, especially for a temporary theatre. And then he had them brought back to his house and put up in his atrium.
Yeah, so again. It was a write-off. You know, I'm claiming this on work expenses.
Yeah, it was a way of avoiding the taxes. Yeah. I don't know how he got 360 into the atrium of his house. Yeah, so, you know, all of this might be exaggeration. But again, this is having a go at Scaurus. And Pliny tells us this as well.
Mm.
Lucullus himself is kind of, if I just read you that Pliny extract that I read to you, you mightn't necessarily think Lucullus is an extravagant person or Pliny's having a go at him. But Pliny has a go at him elsewhere.
Mm.
He comes in for a lot of it in other writers too. He does things that are somehow against nature. So he excavates a mountain near Naples. He builds a channel from his villa out to the sea, basically so that he can get out to sea without having to cross land, and he can get the fish straight up to his villa. And that costs more than the house itself, building this channel.
Mm.
This is my favorite bit of this story. Pompey is supposed to have called him Xerxes in a toga, which is a reference to the fact that Xerxes, the Persian king, when trying to invade Greece in the 5th century BC, is supposed to have cut a channel through northern Greece, Mount Athos, I think it is, through that peninsula to get there faster.
Mm.
But that's to get a navy through, not just to get access from his villa to the sea. That was a great war project, I suppose. This is just personal fiddling around with nature so that he can so that he can please himself in his villa by the sea. And Pliny calls him one of, and this is always a negative word, one of the piscinarii. A piscinarius is someone who's obsessed with fish. And this is having expensive fish in your pond, in your villa, and admiring them. Pliny says, when Lucullus died, the fish from his pond sold for 4 million sesterces. The fish from his pond sold for a senator's basic wealth.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Which is huge.
Yeah.
I can't imagine how fish would cost that much, but they were highly prized, very rare, presumably. Mm. And this is all part of his ridiculous extravagance. You got to tie that up also with the fact that Lucullus had been a really successful Roman general, much admired. And then at some point, had sort of given it all up and just given himself to the high life. There's this idea that you have more and more stuff just for the sake of it.
Yeah.
Which I think we still potentially have moral problems with.
But I want to say that the archaeological record kind of tells us that the Romans, by and large, had no problem with living like this. That the people who had this wealth thought it was a good thing to be this wealthy, to show it off, to have big villas with nice mosaics and heated floors and what have you. That there was really no issue with it. It's the people who are writing about it seem to have the issue with it.
Well, I mean, if we come back to Seneca, he's kind of both, isn't he? He's got extreme wealth.
Mm.
He has a problem kind of with himself. This is why he has to go and live for a few days a year just with one slave.
Yeah.
Only one. Could you cope just with one in some little, I don't know, garret or attic somewhere? Because he feels that there is something morally corrupt about living this way and being dedicated to it and being unable to live without it. I guess there's that fear that what would you do if it all fell apart? And he needs to know that he can cope. And it does come back to the emperors. All right, so this kind of behavior is also attributed to the emperors. And of course, it's the bad emperors, it's the Neros. Therefore, it's also connected with despotism.
Mm. Yeah, I guess so. So it's your Caligula with his nemeships and those sort of things who are thought of as bad emperors.
Kind of vanity engineering, I would call it. Not Trajan or Claudius rebuilds the port at Ostia.
Mm.
Good practical engineering, or even let's build a beautiful space in the center of Rome because we're now the head of a world empire and the city needs to look better than it does, like Augustus does.
But this comes back to Augustus, you know, he's not just, okay, yes, doing it for himself to better his reputation. He's also doing it for the benefit of Rome. Rome does get something out of those structures. Rome gets something out of the port at Ostia. Yeah. It's not just Caligula making a massive ship.
Suetonius tells us, chapter 37 of Caligula's life, he built lodges and villas with no consideration of expense. It's about the expense. I mean, Caligula leaves the public purse almost empty after only 4 years. So it is about that extravagance that does have that flow on for the Roman public. Just to step back to Augustus, I do just want to mention that, yes, his public image is that he does things to beautify public spaces. So it's for the Romans. Of course, it's for him too. It's for his reputation.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He knows that this is now making the city look beautiful and he'll be remembered for that. And, you know, that whole thing about emperors who don't put their names on things, like Hadrian not putting his name on the Pantheon.
True, yes.
He gets remembered for not putting his name on it. So
true, yes.
The memory is still there. The respect and the accolades still come to them.
Yeah, we remember him for his modesty.
Yeah. Exactly.
This is That's a weird thing to say about Hadrian as well, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, Hadrian was also criticized for extravagant kind of over-the-top building. The Pantheon is, again, a public space. It's a temple. And there's also this idea of doing the impossible, again, going against nature, building out into sea, cutting into mountains, building up land that shouldn't be built up. And the ships you mentioned sound a bit like cruise vessels. And, you know, within these spaces, you have colonnades and you have jewels set into them. Actually, this is true of the ships as well. There's banquet halls, there's baths, there's fruit trees on ships. This is kind of mixing up nature that made some of these Roman moralists sound unhappy. I feel like I haven't persuaded you, though. I've just made you think this would be a great lifestyle to have.
look, I think it's fair to say that without this luxury, without these things to look at, to be discovered, like if an archaeologist is at a dig site and he digs up a house and you go, great, he digs up a house and he can show us how those people live. If he uncovers a beautiful bust of something, that is what is going to get the attention. We are drawn to the luxury. And if it wasn't for that luxury, there wouldn't be the attention and fascination on ancient Rome, I think.
I think some of that is true, and it's still today, yeah, I mean, they dug up a head of Augustus recently.
They dug up a head of Augustus,
and
yes.
And that, you know, everyone wants, and I'm, you know, we've got plenty of heads of Augustus.
We do. But this is a nice one, and we dug it up recently.
another head of Augustus doesn't tell us that much, whereas the less exciting stuff that doesn't get the press attention, or not as much of it, is actually increasing our knowledge of how the Romans lived. I think it's a kind of false dichotomy as well, in that both of these are good to know about. And I guess I'm not really talking so much about what's good or bad as what Roman writers thought was good or bad. And maybe this is the lesson from all of this, is one of the ways Augustus came to power, by really dealing with this idea that's there, at least in some of the Roman public, that there is a reason why Rome has started eating itself in the civil wars. And that is, they haven't been paying enough attention to the simple life and to religious piety and to good family values. And he claims he's going to deal with that. And that's one of the reasons he's successful. He uses that fear. He uses that fear about extravagance and decadence, which is tied up with immorality, right? Women, God knows what, sleeping with everyone, let's get those adultery laws in, let's make sure that women aren't dressed too extravagantly, let's make sure men get back into their togas. He passes a law saying that men have to wear the toga in public, in public spaces, certainly in the forum. So it's all tied together. And even if rich Romans carry on with this lifestyle, it kind of doesn't matter, as long as this discourse exists that people like Augustus can use to talk about what should be the good way to live, the correct way for Romans to live.
That was Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, head of the Department of Languages and Linguistics at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome, so until the next episode, I am Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.